During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Dress the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, we are back for part two of our interview with Marcellus Reynolds, who is joining us again to discuss the third and final book in his Supreme Women series. But first, some quick and very exciting announcements from Dressed.
Yes, our Paris fashion history trip in the fall sold out very quickly, so we are looking to actually potentially add a second week, which would be October 12th through the 19th. So if you are interested in this second week, you can email us at hello@dresshistory.com to register your interest for this potential trip. We're building the list as we speak.
Yes. And also, I am very pleased to announce that part two of my course, What Women Wore to the Revolution, is now open for registration. So I'm going to talk more about this in detail at the conclusion of today's episode, but just so you know, starting June 23rd, we will meet once a month to explore the evolution and revolution of women's fashion across four of the most iconic eras in fashion histories, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I'm also pleased to announce that I've added a book club component to this class as well. And you can register for both at our website, dresshistory.com/classes.
And speaking of icons, Cass, as you and Marcellus discussed on Wednesday's episode, the first two books in his Supreme Women series focus on iconic Black women who revolutionized modeling and acting. And his final book, which we are going to dig into today, Supreme Sirens, Iconic Black Singers Who Revolutionized Music, focuses on the multi-hyphenate performers who are so much more than just singers. They are dancers, actors, business moguls, and for our intents and purposes, image architects and fashion icons.
Yes, and on Wednesday, we just barely skimmed the surface of the influence and impact of the incredible women at the heart of the Supreme Sirens book. And today, we meet many, many more, starting with one of the most powerful voices and forces in music, whose career and style evolution spans six decades. So let's jump back into our conversation about the godmother of soul, the one, the only, Patti LaBelle. I'm obsessed with the Patti LaBelle images in the book. Because again, a lot of these contemporary artists, you're not necessarily aware of their entire career trajectory. And so I went down this rabbit hole in terms of Patti LaBelle's style and career history, because she had some wild style, especially when she was part of the Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, right? So she started out with them in the 1960s, which is fairly conservative, matching ensembles like the Supremes did. And then moving into the 70s, it's like, wow. Can you talk a little bit about the 70s Patti LaBelle, and specifically maybe the image in your book?
Okay, we're not giving Patti LaBelle her flowers, right, enough. And that's what's so important about these books, because we know Patti LaBelle from the 80s with the crazy hair, singing On My Own, or, you know, all the hits she released in the 80s. But Patti LaBelle has been in music for, what, maybe 50 years now, because she started in, I think, the late 50s, early 60s with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. And I mean, the audacity to, like, I'm going to be the front singer and the singer. I'm going to start my own band, my own group, and I'm going to name my backup singers the Bluebells. You know what I mean? Because of who she was then, when she gets into the 70s, she drops her first name and starts a group, but more of a band with Sarah Dash, legend, and Nona Hendrix, legend, called LaBelle. And they release one of the greatest hits of the 70s, Lady Marmalade. And those performances that LaBelle gave, they were literally like Elton John, right? In the 70s. They gave you theater. They weren't singing just R&B. They were singing rock songs. They were literally like the Rolling Stones, like these three Black women. They were giving leather bodysuits and platform boots and feathers. And it was almost like a Vegas show. You know what I mean? And they were coming out and they were performing. They were singing their hearts out. And so when I wrote about Patti LaBelle, I knew that I was going to have to tell that story completely. I was going to have to start with this idea of Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells being this sort of Motown act, even though I don't know that they were with Motown, but they were very, a girls group of the 60s. And how Patti somehow morphed that into the 70s, into LaBelle, which was a highly influential rock group, right? They weren't just this R&B band, it was more rock. And their performances, their stage personas were legend. And then that goes from into the 70s, into the 80s. And then finally the band breaks up and each one of them goes their own way. Because Nona Hendrix could have very easily been in Supreme Sirens. She has a voice and her music was insane. And again, influential in that same way. We talk a lot about Grace Jones, but before there was Grace Jones, there was Patti LaBelle and the group LaBelle doing what Grace Jones ended up doing, using fashion to create a moment, to sell a character.
Yeah. And I'm looking at this one image in your book, which is Patti is in this white feathered headdress. She has this all white ensemble. Then she has this studded armor, basically breastplates, shoulder pads. She has cuffs and then matching boots. And I did some research into who is doing these costumes. And it's this designer, Larry Legaspi, who I dress listeners, I'm probably going to be doing a episode on him because he's one of those kind of forgotten designers who was incredibly influential in the 70s and 80s. Of course, unfortunately passed away from AIDS. But Rick Owens wrote a book about him just the last couple of years and kind of reviving his legacy. And so it's Larry who created these incredible ensembles that Patti and LaBelle's are wearing. And so more on that coming soon, because what an incredible visual feast for the eyes.
You really did a deep dive.
I did.
And Larry Legaspi, for fashion people like us, is legend.
Yes,
he's
exactly.
Absolutely legend. He doesn't get mentioned in the same breath as, let's say, a Bob Mackie.
Exactly.
They were doing kind of similar things, but I would actually say that Larry Legaspi was doing them harder, cooler,
more avant-garde,
more edgy, more avant-garde.
Yeah. As evidenced, I don't know, is it who's the woman next to Patti in this image, but she has a black feathered ensemble. She has the silver, I think it's page 159. She has a silver breastplate, a silver like belt, and then this feathered skirt that cascades from it with a matching feathered vest, essentially.
I love that's Sarah Dash who's okay. In the all black outfit, again with the feathers, again giving you an outfit. Giving you a fashion moment, right? That's Sarah Dash. And then the woman next to her is Nona Hendrix. So that's the moment, right? And then, you know, these women had to keep up with Patti LaBelle. So they couldn't be wallflowers. They had to come out there with outfits on, with voices singing, because Patti would check them if they wasn't 100% right. That's one of my favorite photos in the book. That photo of LaBelle is one of my favorite photos in Supreme Sirens. And it was very important to put photos like that photo of women performing on stage in this book, because I wanted Supreme Sirens to be alive. I wanted it to feel like you were at a concert. I wanted you to feel like you were watching them perform. I wanted you to want to go see. I want you to look at this photo and I want you to go actually find that performance and watch that performance and see these women like doing their thing. see them like sirens sirening. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'll link to it. It looks like they wore these stage ensembles all through 1975. So I'll definitely post, at least on social media, an image, because it's just incredible. One of my favorite, like I said, so many rabbit holes to go down. There's also that fabulous photo of the Pointer Sisters, who look like they're all in 1940s ensembles, which is super interesting because they're a 60s and 70s girl group. Do you know anything about that image?
Again, these Black women are performance artists. They're creating characters specific to the music that they're performing at that moment. So the Pointer Sisters is an all-girl group of sisters. And it's so funny because there's a cut, there's an edit, there's a pass, book passes. There's a pass of Supreme Sirens that's all girl groups. And it was very hard to decide which girl groups made it into the book, right? And it usually came down to if the front person became a star. So you have Destiny's Child and you have the Supremes. Destiny's Child fronted by Beyoncé. The Supremes fronted by Diana Ross. But then you have a group like the Pointer Sisters that literally everybody in the Pointer Sisters could sing. Everybody in the Pointer Sisters has star power. Yeah, a couple of those Pointer Sisters released solo efforts, but they never did as well as the group, right? The group was the thing. And with the Pointer Sisters, it was always like, again, it was performance art. So you've got the Pointer Sisters all dressed like the Andrews Sisters from the 40s or the 50s and using fashion in that way and dressing ladylike. Or there's pictures of them that all dress like Billie Holiday and these very beautiful gowns with like big, you know, camellias in their hair, giving an homage to that. And then as you move more into the 80s, they became very 80s with the hair and the makeup and the glamour, right? And the drama of the 80s, those kind of outfits. But in the 70s, there was also a moment where they were like kind of disco girls. So you had these amazing like Halston-esque bias cut dresses, you know, giving you like Donna Summer sexy level. And the Pointer Sisters really used fashion to communicate what the theme of that record or maybe that album was. And the Pointer Sisters are so interesting because they crossed genres. They had a country hit. The Pointer Sisters actually started out, some people say they started out as more of a country music act. We're having these conversations right now about whether Beyoncé can release a country album. The Pointer Sisters won a Grammy for a song, I believe. I can't remember the name of the song that was a country music hit, but that's what they did. So not only did they dress like these period girls and release a song like, I know we can make it, I know that we can, and these four-part harmonies that feel very like 1940s, 1950s, again, the Andrews Sisters, again, these girl groups, but they dress like that to drive the point home.
Oh, that's super interesting. I'll have to go out and listen to that.
And the Pointer Sisters do not get the flowers I think they deserve. For me, it came down to there was this moment because each book is sort of heavy in certain areas. And this book was heavy in the 70s, moving into the 80s. Because again, we had Patti LaBelle. We had people like Minnie Riperton, and we had Donna Summer. We had these people that were disco artists. We had these people that were like R&B artists. And so there was a moment where I was trying to decide between the Pointer Sisters and Sister Sledge. And there's a couple of other acts that were groups, all girl groups that came to prominence in the 70s. But I kept coming back to the idea of the Pointer Sisters using fashion to really create characters and to really create an image. And they did that more than any of their contemporaries.
Yeah, you look at them immediately, you're like, they're dressed in 1940s, like probably actual vintage. Some of their suits actually do look like vintage 1940s suits. So that's fantastic. They're sitting on a Louis Vuitton trunk. It's pretty fantastic.
It's pretty fantastic, right? I saw the Louis Vuitton trunk and I was like, okay, ladies, I see what you did there. And I appreciate it.
Yeah. So thank you for clarifying or bringing that to light. So that's really, really fascinating. And you know, we love good vintage on the show. So, and speaking about women's impact on fashion and beauty standards, you have a really beautiful homage to Whitney Houston, who I know had a pretty profound influence on you as a kid. Can you talk about what Whitney meant to you and then other girls in your school? I really enjoyed reading that story.
Whitney Houston is probably the greatest voice of all time, and she means so much to people across the globe. This is the greatest voice. But specifically to me, and specifically to maybe people of a certain age, Whitney Houston means just a little bit more. Whitney Houston started her career as a teen model, and she modeled in the early 80s. And she was in two very important publications for young women. She was in 17 and she was in Young Miss. And 17 back in the day in the 80s was hugely important. And she existed in a space where there were no other Black models. And if there were Black models who were young, those models were lighter skinned and probably had like blonde hair or like green eyes. But Whitney was identifiably Black with her truly brown skin. And Whitney had a little afro back then. And she was that girl on the cover of 17. And if Whitney Houston wore something in 17, you better believe that next Monday, every Black girl was working that outfit or a similar outfit. And they would do interviews with the models in 17. And Whitney would always talk about being a very good girl and singing in church. And her mother was Sissy Houston and her cousin was Dionne Warwick. And she wanted to be a singer when she grew up. And school was very important to her, and juggling like homework and singing and modeling. And Whitney did not have a boyfriend. No, no. You know, Whitney was a very serious girl. And she was a role model for girls of a certain era. And when I reached out to Whitney's family to clear the photos, they asked me to see the Whitney section. And I told them Whitney Houston is very important to me because as a little gay boy in high school, I was reading 17 magazine and I was looking for the Black model. And so when I saw Whitney Houston on the cover of 17 eating an ice cream cone next to a white model, it was like, wow, that's inclusion. That's diversity before we were even having those conversations. So of course, little Black girls are buying whatever Whitney's selling. They want to look like Whitney. They want to dress like Whitney. They want to be like Whitney. And I sent that family that essay, and the notes I got back were like, thank you. Nobody ever talks about Whitney's modeling career, and they never talk about the impact that she had on young girls. 17 Magazine used to do tours of malls back in the day, and people would wait for hours to talk to the 17 models. So you had little girls of every age, from like preteens to teenagers, at the malls on Saturday and Sunday, standing in line to talk to Whitney Houston, to talk to the other models that were in 17, to get their 17 magazine signed by them.
Amazing. I had no idea she was a model. That's another thing that I absolutely loved about this story. I had no idea that that's how she started out.
I almost included Whitney in Supreme Models. That was the impact that she had on certain people. She didn't model for long. Of course, she became a superstar very quickly. But if you know anything about Whitney, that first cover of her album, she's wearing like a Norma Kamali swimsuit. Whitney was always giving you fashion because she knew the language of fashion. She came from being a top teen model. I think she was represented by like either Wilhelmina or Ford. Whitney was doing her thing. If she had stayed a model, she would have been a big model. But she decided to be a singer and left modeling behind. But Whitney Houston was not just a model. She was a cover girl, honey. She had covers.
Is there anyone else that you can think of off the top of your head that represent within Supreme Sirens or any of the books, kind of that multi-hyphenate as it relates to fashion? Is there anyone else we're leaving out that is incredibly significant in terms of their influence?
The queen, the legend. The icon, Missy Elliott, is on the cover. First of all, let's talk about the cover of Supreme Sirens. Missy Elliott is on the cover with her bi-level curly bob, Black. She's got like these gold nails on that have texture, Black. She's got giant hoop earrings, and the hoop earring is such a staple in Black culture, right? That goes all the way back to Africa, Black. And then she's wearing like a track jacket. And I'm sure the track jacket is like Versace or Gucci or something, right? And she's got the gold chains and the bling around her neck. But for me, the most important moment on that cover is Missy Elliott wearing the Gucci sunglasses. It is fashion. It is Missy. Missy is, again, that multi-hyphenate performer. Missy is less a rapper to me than she is a performance artist. Think about the first time we saw Missy Elliott in the rain, where she's wearing those incredible sunglasses. I can't remember who the designer of the sunglasses, those sunglasses are, but she's wearing those incredible sunglasses in the rain. And she's wearing that giant trash bag blow up jumpsuit. And she's singing in that staccato way that she raps and sings, and the fisheye camera, right? That was such a fashion moment that changed the way that we saw Black rap. It was more avant-garde fashion than it was rapper giving you a tracksuit. It was more avant-garde fashion than what Salt and Pepper were doing, or maybe Queen Latifah, who was giving you the Black woman with a crown and the Afrocentric thing. Missy Elliott was giving you this performance art piece. She was changing the way that we saw the Black female rapper. She was also expanding the way that rap artists perform. And she's always done this bit of a twist on fashion with each album, with each video. Like, she is a video vanguard that uses fashion that expands the boundaries of like fashion, art, music. But then let's talk about Missy Elliott, the producer, and the from people from like Mariah Carey to Whitney Houston to Aaliyah. Like, she's worked with Ciara. She's worked with so many artists. And she's a songwriter, a producer. She's a rapper. She's the first Black woman, the first Black female rapper inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She's so much more than just like a rapper. I don't even consider what Missy does as rap. It's like she's created this genre. It's almost like a rapper like Missy is like a rapper like Busta Rhymes. What they do is so different than what other rappers are doing. And Missy uses fashion, and she uses her voice, and she uses these different techniques to do something each time that's very different. Each time she does it, that's expanding the boundaries of music.
And Dress listeners, we actually had her stylist, who has been integral to all of these really famous looks, June Ambrose. She came on the show a couple of years ago, and we got to talk to her because she's part and parcel to creating with Missy these really iconic fashion and music moments that you just alluded to.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free, and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, Dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Something I really love about the book too is that you interviewed Missy Elliott, which was really special. And all of these books feature interviews you did with many of these women, which is a really personal touch that I'm sure is very special to you and very special to us reading it. So I'd love if you could talk a little bit about what that experience has been like for you meeting and interviewing some of these women. And are there any experiences in particular that you would like to share with us?
Okay, so if Abrams had their way, if my publisher had their way, these are photography books, they're art books. At the end of the day, they are about the photo, right? They are about the moment that the photo creates. I think of these books as mini encyclopedias. So I try to cram as many facts as possible as I can into the books. So not just looking at the photos, which are beautiful, I want you to learn something about the women, whether it be how many awards they've won, where they came from, their struggles, their triumphs. I want you to learn as much as possible, but I also want the woman to tell her story in her own words where possible. And so I've had over the past 5 years more than 5 years, because I was doing interviews as far back as 2011 for Supreme Models. So I've had the honor of being front and center to listening to some of the most incredible women tell their stories, from someone like Beth Ann Hardison, who was in the Battle of Versailles, to Lynn Whitfield, who is in Supreme Actresses, who won her first Emmy for portraying Josephine Baker in the Josephine Baker story. I love that through line, to now Supreme Sirens, where I got to interview Roberta Flack, who is a multi-Grammy winning artist that is so influential in the world of music. And what was really important about the Roberta Flack interview for me was that she had just had a stroke, but she wanted to tell her story in her own words and be a part of this book. That was super important. I got really close to interviewing Tina Turner, but she was sick. And as we know, she passed away. But what's important about Tina Turner is her team and Tina and her partner knew about the book, and they chose the photos. And Tina wanted to see the book before she passed. And the book wasn't out yet, but I sent them a PDF of the book. So I hope that Tina got to see the love letter to Tina that is her section in the book, right? Because I know she got to choose those photos. That's what's so important about these books. They are the history. So they're going to give you the history as far back as like the early 1900s, in some cases, the late 1800s, and they're going to bring it forward. Read the book because you love Cardi B or Ari Lennox or Summer Walker or Samara Joy. But along the way, you're also going to learn about Josephine Baker, Lena Horne, Mahalia Jackson. You're going to learn something about Sister Rosetta Tharpe. You know, you're going to learn about Sarah Vaughan. That's what the books are.
I loved your interview with Stephanie Mills, too, because we did a Wiz mini-sode a couple months ago because the Wiz is being revived on Broadway. And we did it about the costumes and learning that history and how important Stephanie Mills is, right, to representation, to laying the foundation for Broadway performers to follow in her footsteps. And then, of course, she's still performing. So that was a really special interview, too, to read. Really special interview, too, to read.
The books are always going to be about giving people their flowers that maybe are forgotten or have fallen off. So you have somebody like Stephanie Mills, who originated the role of Dorothy in The Wiz, which is so incredibly important to Broadway and to Black culture. You have plays like The Wiz and Dreamgirls, which created their own dialogue on Broadway. Because Broadway is much like Hollywood. There was this idea that a Black play won't do well. And plays like The Wiz and Dreamgirls turn that idea on their head. People of every race will come and see a performance by beautiful, incredible, talented Black performers. Stephanie Mills also is very important because she was one of the few actresses that performers, because she's a singer, she's an actress, she's a dancer, that transitioned from Broadway into a real career in popular culture. And in the 80s, won a Grammy and released a slew of number one albums and singles. And Stephanie Mills is the voice. Stephanie Mills is the blueprint. When little Black girls sing Home, they're singing Stephanie Mills singing Home. From The Wiz. That's who Stephanie Mills is. And that interview in particular was really important to me because I'll tell you this, this was not an easy book to do. You would think after two other best-selling books, especially the success of Supreme Models, which is continues to be so influential and continues to sell in the art book space, that it would be easy for me to do Supreme Sirens. It was the hardest of the three books to do. The women did not want to participate. It was like a fight to get interviews. It was a fight to clear photos. And it was heartbreaking for me as a person that is doing these books to give these women their flowers, to have these women not support my project, to be a Black, gay, best-selling author of a certain age, to be defying what publishing is about and creating books that celebrate Black women and to not have support from the Black women in the book was devastating. And at a certain point, I wanted to give the book back. I wanted to give my advance back and not do Supreme Sirens. And that was due to the lack of support I was getting from the women depicted inside. And on a day when I was at my lowest, I interviewed Stephanie Mills. And she talked about just that, this idea. These books are about sisterhood. These books are about one Black woman opening the door and holding it open for the next. And she demystified that for me because there is not a lot of sisterhood among Black singers. And Stephanie Mills has been privy to that during her career, this lack of sisterhood among sisters. And she said to me, you have to continue to do you because these are the gifts, your career, your life, your mission is what God gave you. So even though you might not be getting the support from others that you want, as long as you're getting the support from the gift that God gave you, you have to keep going. And it's not about the women in the book. It's about the readers of the book. That's the lesson that Stephanie Mills taught me during her interview, and it got me through. Another important interview in the book that kind of ran along the same lines was Monica's interview. But I'll tell you a little story about, we're getting off track, but I think it's a very important story. This is how I decided for the last two books, Supreme Actresses and Supreme Sirens, who wrote the foreword. I do as many interviews as I can, and I edit them. And the interview that is the most impactful and the most on point for the message of the book as I see it is the interview that becomes the foreword. Then I go back to that person and I say, hey, I already have your interview. Is it possible that we can tweak this and make it the forward? And with Supreme Actresses, that was Gabrielle Union's interview. And Gabrielle Union's interview in Supreme Actresses talked about her frustration with Hollywood. It talked about this idea of always, the bar is always set higher and higher and higher, and how still Black women meet that bar, and then they have to work harder because then Hollywood sets the bar higher. And it was a level of honesty that I found refreshing, but it was also a theme that a lot of the other interviews talked about, right? And so there was something that was so powerful and impactful and urgent and of the moment with Gabrielle's interview that I was like, this is the forward. And with Monica, the forward could have very easily have been Stephanie Mills, because they both impacted me in a very personal way, because I wasn't getting the response from the people in the book that I wanted. I was ready to throw in the towel. I was ready to give up. I was ready to move on. And both of these women were like, don't do that. This is the gift that God gave you. This is the work that you're supposed to be doing. If you don't continue this, as Monica says to me during our interview, if you don't stay the course, the reader is the person that's missing out. That little Black girl who is the reason that you write these books, because you want to inspire her and tell her that her dreams are valid and she can do and be whoever she wants to be. And these women did it. We have a history of Black women becoming successful in the face of adversity. You can too. If you don't write these books, then that little girl might not hear that story. And with Monica, I ended up on my knees praying with Monica. And that gave me the strength to continue to power through to create this last book in the Supreme series. And that's how Monica's interview became the forward.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Marcellus. And thank you for taking us behind the scenes of this incredible book. Thank you for finishing this book and giving this as a gift to the world and all of these people and little girls, as you said, that are going to read it and see themselves represented and see their dreams manifesting before their very eyes. And I hope that you continue this series. Do you have any idea of what you're going to be doing next, if there's a fourth book?
I do not think that there is going to be another Supreme book. I think that this is a book series. What I don't want to do, I've released 3 books in 5 years. That's to lose what's special about the book and have it be like, oh, every other year he's going to release a book, right? These books are very about pop culture, and pop culture really is actresses, models, and singers. I'm not interested in doing sports figures. I'm not introducing a book that's like a melange of different women. These books are very directed because I want to get that message in each book through about the woman included in the book, right? So I don't think that there's another group that I wanna, whose stories I wanna tell. But what I wanna do now is I wanna flip the other 2 books into documentaries like I did with Supreme. Now she's a documentarian, she's a historian. In my mind, I'm a historian. And then I have another fashion documentary that I'm pitching that I don't wanna do a book about, but I think it's an important documentary. And there is a book, it will be a work of fiction. And I think it will tell the story of a little Black gay guy that comes from nowhere who kind of conquers the world of fashion. And I see it as like maybe a very Black gay Devil Wears Prada in a way. That's
fantastic.
The next book I want to write.
Well, we will certainly keep our eyes and ears open for anything you have coming down the pipeline in the future. We'll definitely stay in touch and share what you're doing next. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time and so generous with your stories. This has been such a treat for me, and I know for our listeners as well.
I'm a huge fan of the podcast, as you know, so I'm so honored to be able to come on and do it again. I'm just so thankful to you.
Thank you, Marcellus. This has been wonderful.
Marcellus, thank you so much for joining us on Dressed Again to celebrate the incredible lives, legacies, and fashions of these iconic performers. Dress listeners, we will, of course, link to our past interviews with Marcellus in our show notes, as well as numerous other episodes that intersect with this very topic. And that includes our interviews with Missy Elliott's stylist, June Ambrose, and an interview with another Supreme woman, quite literally in the Supremes, Miss Mary Wilson.
Yes, one of my all-time favorite interviews. May she rest in peace. So this book definitely speaks to many of our past episodes, and it also inspired a future one because I had no idea. I know you knew who Larry Legazpi was, April, but I had no idea about the work and impact of this incredible fashion designer whose high voltage, futuristic fashions defined so much of the drama of the 70s and 80s and was worn, as Marcellus and I discussed, by people like Patti LaBelle, but also Kiss. So now that I've said Kiss, dress listeners, I'm sure you now instantly have an image of Legazpi's work, even if his name has more or less fallen into obscurity since his untimely death in the early 2000s. There is a treasure trove of information about his work in the archive, and I am so excited to bring you an episode in the coming month or so on his life and work, including the fabulous fashions on view in Marcellus's book.
And Cass, I think I've told you this. So Rick Owens has actually written a book on Larry Legazpi. It's sold out. It sold out like immediately. However, when they were taking all the stuff off-site from the collection of Valerie Legazpi, who is his wife, everything had to be appraised. And I was actually the one who did that appraisal. So I got to see all of this insane Larry Legazpi stuff, literally up close, touch it. Valerie even let me try on a few pieces. I saw all the sketches. He did all that, those insane costumes for George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars as well, including if you've ever seen George Clinton's elephant trunk cod piece, which is all in leather. And within the collection, it's not only like the sketches for it, but it's also the piece itself. So I'm very much looking forward to your Larry Legazpi episode. And I definitely have some images that I can shoot your way for Instagram.
Yeah. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about that experience that you just described as well, because I had no idea. On that note, dress listeners, that concludes this portion of the podcast. May you consider your favorite fashion icons, past and present, next time you get dressed.
Listeners, you should absolutely get your hands on Marcellus's book. And you will find a link to that on our bookshelf on bookshop.org in our show notes, where you can also purchase all three of these incredible books on our Dressed bookshelf, which also has an array of our favorite and podcast-featured fashion history titles. Cass, we are now up to more than 140 titles on our Dressed bookshelf, just saying. Dress listeners, we love hearing from you, as always. So if you'd like to reach out to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com, especially if you'd like to join us for a potential second week of the Dressed Fashion History Tour of Paris, which is coming your way on October 12th through 19th, if enough people registered their interest. DressedHistory.com is also where you can find information on our upcoming fashion history tours, classes, and anything else we have up our sleeves, including my now weekly Fashion History Fridays at the Met. So without further ado, Cass, did you want to tell everybody a little bit more about your upcoming class?
I do. I am so excited to finally launch this. And I just want to make it very clear that you do not have to have taken part one of What Women Wore to the Revolution to enjoy this class. So from Depression era fashion fantasies to the make, do, and mend of World War II, from Dior's new look to the liberating micro minis and blue jeans of the 1960s, in What Women Wore to the Revolution, Part 2, we will meet the clothes and the women that continue to captivate our imaginations and really, literally shape the clothes that we wear to this very day. So the 1930s is fashion fantasies and realities in the Great Depression era. So we're going to be looking at the dichotomy between the fantasy of that haute glam as presented by high fashion designers, but also Hollywood, and how that compares to the lived reality of people's experiences during the Great Depression. So this is actually something that American sportswear designers really understood and will cater to. They'll really rise to the occasion in the 1930s. And then moving into the 40s, of course, is defined by World War II. So we're going to be looking at women's lives during World War II through the lens of the clothes they wore, which held any number of meanings, including having subversive qualities that represented resistance. And this includes French women under Nazi occupation, but also Mexican American Pachuca Zoot Suiters, as well as the Japanese American women interned in U.S. concentration camps. 1950s, golden age of haute couture. We're going to actually go behind the scenes of this iconic era to meet the working women at its heart. So models and muses, designers and photographers, editors and journalists. And then we'll conclude with one of the most revolutionary decades in fashion history, the 1960s, when all sartorial and gender codes were turned upside down and women, after a century-long battle, finally won the right to wear pants, among many, many other things. So I really, really hope you join me. I'm super excited. I'm super excited for the book club element as well. And you can find all that information at dresstissue.com/classes.
Also, if you have any questions, you can always DM us about our classes and tours on Instagram, which is @dress_podcast. That's where you're going to find images and reels accompanying each week's episodes. And if you want to find the Instagram content specifically connected to this episode, you can check out the hashtag dressed364 and dressed365. As always, thank you so much for your continued support. More Dressed coming your way next week. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.